Omaha Public Radio presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club on Noon Forum. Today's guest speaker will be Cliff Robertson, who recently assumed the position of Chief Executive Officer of Catholic Health Initiatives Nebraska Southwest Iowa Network. Dr. Robertson will discuss his vision and plans under study and development by Allegiant Creighton Health, named for the second consecutive year as one of the nation's 15 top health systems by Truven Health Analytics. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, July 24, 2014, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Gary Kerr, a member of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee.
There have been a lot of changes in hospital and doctor health services locally. I'm pleased today to have as our Noon Forum guest the new CEO of Catholic Health Initiatives Nebraska Southwest Iowa Network, Allegiant Creighton Health. Dr. Cliff Robertson, before coming to Nebraska, served as the interim CEO of St. Luke's Medical Center in Houston and as COO of Franciscan Health System in Washington State, where he was responsible for daily operations and strategic direction of the seven hospital system. Dr. Robertson is an experienced family practice physician and health system executive. Dr. Robertson will talk for about a half hour or so, take questions for the last half hour. There is paper and pencil at your table. Please write down your questions and they will be brought to me to ask from the podium. So join me in welcoming Dr. Cliff Robertson.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for the invitation from the Omaha Press Club. I'm excited to be here. I'm actually excited to be in Nebraska. I thought today what I'd try to do is talk to you a little bit about our organization. Our holding name is the Network. We will have a new name that we will be rolling out in the not-too-distant future. But I thought I'd talk a little bit about the Network, give you a little bit of my background and the history of around our organization, and then talk more importantly about how we see healthcare changing and how we're going to respond to the changes in healthcare that really are necessary, that need to happen, and are really happening all around us. The healthcare is going to change, needs to change, and we're trying to prepare for that. And then I'll be happy to answer any questions that I possibly can. So just a brief introduction of myself. So I've been with the parent organization, CHI, for 19 years. I actually lived in the Northwest for the last 19 years. I'm a family physician by training, although I haven't had clinical responsibilities now for about a little over 5 years. I almost ended up as a rural family physician. One of the practices I almost joined after leaving the Army. The Army put me through the last 3 years of medical school, was out on the Olympic Peninsula. I ended up choosing a different practice, which was on the Olympic Peninsula, but it was in a community called Gig Harbor, Washington, which is essentially a bedroom community of Tacoma, so it wasn't actually rural. I've had opportunities on the physician enterprise side, so I've been the president of a very large medical group, and then I've also been blessed with the opportunity to be responsible for acute care operations in the Franciscan Health System. The only thing up there that really I think is unique and I always like to point out to folks is I also own a business. So my uncle, my mom's youngest brother, is a couple years older than I am. We are franchisees. We actually have 200 employees in two different states. And so we're in a business in an industry that was one I would describe was sort of right in the tension point, if you will, of the Affordable Care Act. So what flavors my biases, my perspective of the world and of healthcare is I'm a family doc, I'm a primary care physician, but I also own a business, and I've also been on the side of trying to understand how to provide health insurance to employees who, in our industry, you know, make between $35,000 and $45,000 a year. I own a bunch of barbershops, just in case you were wondering. I grew up in Denver, so coming to Omaha feels very much like home because I see blue sky and sun more often than not, and went to University of Colorado for undergrad and then to Ohio State for medical school. So I realize, and I will acknowledge today up front, that I am going to do my very best to be a Husker football fan, but based on my background, I am conflicted. I'll take the hits for that right up front. A little bit about our organization. So in 95, Allegiant was formed when the Sisters of Mercy, the Mercy System here locally in Emmanuel, came together, brought their assets together, and created this joint operating arrangement. The Mercies were part of one of the founding orders of what was also being formed at the same time, which was Catholic Health Initiatives. So CHI was formed, was in the process of being formed about that same time, where numerous faith-based systems, Catholic systems, orders of nuns, brought their assets together to create a larger, nationally oriented Catholic health system, and that is CHI. In November of 2012, so almost 2 years ago, the CHI became the sole sponsor of the Allegiant Health System. So Emmanuel transferred their sponsorship, their ownership, over to CHI. And so for the last 2 years, the Allegiant Creighton Health System has been solely sponsored by CHI. In Nebraska, we also have what was called CHI Nebraska. So these are the communities of Grand Island, Nebraska City, Kearney, Lincoln, and have physicians and clinics and hospitals that are really out in greater Nebraska as well. So when CHI became the sole sponsor of the Allegiant system, the idea was then to begin to bring the two CHI organizations together and to try to create a coordinated statewide health system here in Nebraska and southwest Iowa. And as I said, the holding name is The Network. We don't have a new name to reveal just yet. So I thought I'd tell you a little bit about us so you understand our organization, and I'll share some things with you that you may or may not know. We have about 15,000, almost 16,000 employees across the two states. We have more than 3,100 physicians, and these are physicians on active medical staff. So these aren't docs that are employed by us, but these are physicians that are credentialed to practice in our hospitals across the two states. And just to give you a magnitude of the size of our organization, we have our payroll, our fiscal year just ended in June 30th, and so our wages and benefits were almost $1 billion, a little over $1 billion for the last fiscal year. So a large organization, obviously has a large economic impact across the two states. We've got more than 150 locations, over 1.2 million primary care visits occurred in our organization last year. So touching lots of patients in just about every community across the state, and granted, in the more western Nebraska, we don't have much of a presence. What's really neat and what was interesting to me, the reason I wanted to be part of this organization, is that we now have an academic relationship with Creighton University School of Medicine. The faculty are all part of our Allegiant Creighton Clinic, or most of them are part of our Allegiant Creighton Clinic. And as you know, Creighton University Medical Center is now part of our system. So we are embedding this academic approach to care and quality and innovation really across our organization. And we're one of three sub-organizations inside CHI that have these academic relationships. It's very positive. It's very powerful from my perspective in the sense that being involved or having the opportunity to be involved in training the next generation of clinicians, whether they're pharmacists or physicians, is a wonderful thing, and it's a great opportunity we have here in Nebraska in the network. One shameless plug, and I can take no credit for this, it was the clinical staff and support staff and leadership of the Allegiant Creighton Health System that has done incredibly well and has been recognized now 2 years in a row by Truven. And you can go out and look if you want, but Truven's a company that uses publicly available data to rank systems from a quality and an outcomes perspective. And so the ACH side of our organization is now 2 years in a row been a top 15 health system. And it's, I know in Tacoma, the Franciscan Health System, we were doing everything we could do to make it on that list, and weren't successful. Talk to you a little bit about our sort of our model. So, you know, what you probably don't see very often, but I'm more than willing to tell you about, is we just finished our fiscal year, and we don't have audited financials yet, so I'm being a little vague because it'll be somewhere between 3.2 and 3.4%. That's the operating margin, or the profits that we generated, the excess revenues, we like to call them, last year. So you can do the math on an organization that has about $2 billion in revenue, a little over $2 billion in revenue. We generate about a $65 to $70 million margin for the year. It's important for you to know that because what you'll also hopefully understand in here is what we're also doing is making huge investments back into the state of Nebraska and Iowa. First of all, an electronic record. So we still have Epic, our electronic record, to deploy to our greater Nebraska facilities and clinics. And that's a process that'll take us another couple of years. It's probably $150 million in capital investment to make that happen. We also are committing to something over $150 million to rebuild an ambulatory academic medical center campus that'll be up here close to, over there, right across, close to the Creighton University Medical Center somewhere, and are going to remodel our Bergen facility so that we can relocate the academic inpatient care and inpatient services to our Bergen campus, two or three years down the line. That's somewhere between $150 and $170 million is our best estimate, which will be invested back into our state, our local economies. That doesn't even include the probably 100 to 120 million over the next 3 years we'll make investments in just upgrading equipment, adding new technology to our hospitals and our clinics, and really just trying to keep pace with the state of the art care that that's needed here in Nebraska as well as in across the river in southwest Iowa. So here's just a little bit more about us. So we've got 16 hospitals in total, one academic medical center, six critical access hospitals, and then we have nine, acute or more tertiary level type hospitals spread across the two states. We're the largest provider of behavioral health services. So as you all know, and as a primary care doc, I'll chime in here. We underinvest as a society in the care of those individuals that have behavioral or mental health problems. It is part of our mission. It is not, it's not an economic driver of our financial success, but it's something that's very near and dear to our heart, and it's what we do. So with whether it's Lasting Hope or our facility out in Kearney, we're very committed to the care of the underserved, and in this case, it's patients, it's individuals that are afflicted with behavioral health problems. We have a couple of specialty hospitals. We have inpatient rehab. We joint venture a physical therapy service out in central Nebraska. We also have partnerships with physicians, so we have some freestanding imaging centers and surgery centers that are also in partnership with our physician colleagues. The crown jewel of our organization, from my perspective as a primary care doc, is our clinically integrated network. And what that is it's called Uninet. It's a large organization. There's about 2,200 or so physicians and advanced practice clinicians that make it up. It is a tool. It is a company. It's an entity that allows us to work collaboratively, primary care docs, specialists, and hospitals to really manage the care that patients need and do it in a way in which everybody's aligned and everybody has the same ability to deliver on the same goals and objectives, which are quality and patient satisfaction or service, and doing it in the most cost-effective manner. So a little bit about CHI. So there are a lot of folks, since I've gotten here, I've heard a lot of press folks say, well, CHI, and it's a corporate conglomerate, and it's based in Denver. So let me just tell you, I've worked as part of CHI for the last 19 years. So our corporate office is in Denver. What CHI's model is to be able to use the scale that they can gain at a national level for things like purchasing supplies and devices and contracts with vendors to be able to help lower the cost in the local market. The decisions aren't made in Denver, in spite of what somebody might say. The decisions are made locally. And in fact, what I've told the leadership team of our network is that if all the decisions start getting made in Omaha, then we've even failed. Care is local. It is between patients and clinicians in a community. Our goal and our role is to support how care is delivered, not only just in Omaha and the metro, but in greater Nebraska, in Iowa as well, and to make sure that we're doing the absolute right things, best things for the patients. What that doesn't mean is that we'll accept a lower standard of care if you live in Kearney or Grand Island than Omaha. And so our charge as leadership here for the network is to collaboratively work together to figure out how we actually can make the investments and support our community so that the service and the care that is delivered in anywhere outside of Omaha matches or exceeds what's delivered in Omaha. We use the word consumer on this top line about consumer focused, and we do that very specifically. It's because this is more than taking care of patients who are sick. As the world is changing in healthcare, and it needs to change, we really are focused on helping people, you know, manage their own medical issues, but stay healthy and prevent sickness, prevent illness. So again, that's why, you know, as a family doc, this is music to my ears. You know, I've practiced and lived in a healthcare world that's been very focused on specialties and sort of the high end, the transplants and all of that stuff that's very rare, doesn't occur very often. It's amazing things we can do in this country for trauma victims and people that need organ transplants. But most of healthcare is delivered in a primary care office, and it's between a clinician and a patient and their family generally. And we need to stay focused on helping folks stay healthy and out of the hospitals, away from our hospitals. As I said, the whole goal to be a stronger system allows us all to really just share knowledge. So we have some very interesting innovation that's occurring around CHI that's quickly being spread across CHI because we bring docs together. So we have a national cardiovascular service line as an example. And what that means is we take heart surgeons and cardiologists from our various communities and markets and bring them together and talk about who's performing well, whose metrics are the best, what are they doing differently, how do we actually get all of our programs, heart programs in this example, up to the exact same top level standards, and how do we have the clinicians engaged working with each other to achieve that end. We also are doing some things that people call bold. We understand that employing providers, physicians and advanced practice clinicians, is something that we have to be able to do because more and more physicians are choosing to leave the private practice of medicine and to become, you know, to put on a team jersey and to be part of a system. And so we've developed what we call our CHI Physician Enterprises. It's otherwise known as CHIPS. We've developed CHI Physician Enterprise, physician services, so that we can actually get very, very good and very cost effective at managing the practice of clinicians, be they nurse practitioners or PAs or physicians. And so we're one of the only organizations that's really looking to do that at a much larger scale. We believe it'll add efficiencies, help us lower costs over time, and actually allow us to be better at this part of our industry, which is the physician enterprise side or the physician practice side. The other thing is we're very committed to new services. So you probably saw the Omaha World Herald article about our quiet launch of virtual primary care. So if you think about what we're doing, and we've done this, is something that we did in Tacoma and we've also launched in Kentucky, we are now making available through smartphone or your computer or even a telephone the ability to access a provider, a nurse or a nurse practitioner or a physician, and, you know, for some basic primary care type conditions, be able to treat you virtually. We can do it safe, we can do it legally, and we can do it in a much more cost-effective manner. We are doing that because what that does, providing that service, allows for a small subset of, you know, conditions and patients, we can avoid having somebody at, you know, 11 o'clock at night having to go to an emergency room and wait in an ER emergency room to get a condition addressed that could have been addressed, you know, from their home via the digital technology that exists today. So we're doing that at our own expense, potential expense, because obviously ER visits are revenue from a hospital's perspective, but we're doing it because it's the right thing and it actually puts the patient in the center of the decision. So that's just one example of the kind of things that we're doing here locally and really across our larger organization. So for us, so, you know, what does this mean for us going forward? So, you know, our vision is to become, and we use this lingo, MBO, which just stands for market-based organization. We're going to move. Now we're bringing these two legacy organizations together, and we now have the Creighton University School of Medicine, not the School of Medicine, but the Medical Center and the faculty. And we're going to move towards creating a single integrated academic health system that will cover, you know, Southwest Iowa and Nebraska. We made a decision as an organization about 8 or 9 years ago that we were not going to be focused on the hospital side of healthcare, that we were going to move to the side of prevention and ambulatory care and preventative care, primary care is what I meant to say, because we knew even 10 years ago that the world had to change and that organizations that were solely, you know, focused on acute care or hospital care and not focused on primary care and prevention wouldn't be the right organizational design as healthcare transforms in this country. I'm more than happy to answer questions about what does that really mean, because there are some specifics that we can talk about. We also will be the best position to improve health and well-being across the country. So one of the things I learned as a primary care doc in the 90s is that trying to help patients stay well and to coordinate care between the specialists and the hospital or hospital and nursing home doesn't work if you can't share clinical information. So part of what's going to be different now than when we tried to manage care or coordinate care in the 90s is we're going to actually have information, clinical information. We're going to have a statewide electronic health record that'll be in place over the next few years because that's going to be critical to our ability to really, truly make sure we don't do things like duplicate tests and that we can actually have clinicians that can communicate in a way that was very, very difficult in the old days with paper records. The other thing is that we are here to deliver on the triple aim, and that's language that, if you're not in healthcare, may not understand. But that is essentially focusing on delivering quality, which is really outcomes, and it's service, so it's patient satisfaction, and doing that in the absolute most cost-efficient manner. As a business owner, I will tell you flat out, we have got to get control of our healthcare costs in this country. We've created my profession, my industry. We've created a system, and there's lots of lots of blame to go around. But we have a system that has become unaffordable. We deliver some of the absolute best care in the world, although we don't meet all the targets as far as some of the metrics. If you listen to the World Health Organization, but we've created a system that has now just become unaffordable. And we, as providers, have to be responsible to help transition us to a place where we can get healthcare costs to a place that are sustainable. So how we plan on moving forward is, to expand on existing and develop these value-based contracts. And so I'm sure there'll be questions about that. I won't talk much about that, but that's critical. We've been in the fee-for-service world for 30 years. It is a huge contributor to the issue that we have today around healthcare costs. Don't believe me. Listen to Medicare. Actually, Senator Wyden from Oregon was just quoted in the Congressional Quarterly a month or so ago. You know, his quote was roughly, he wants to take a machete to the Medicare fee-for-service model. So we can talk about that if you're interested, but these value-based agreements are critical to our ability as providers to really do, to innovate and change our system in the right way going forward. We also believe that primary care is critical, and so through our clinically integrated network, we want to be the primary or the large provider of primary care services. And again, the nice thing about a clinically integrated network, it's a way to work with physicians while they're independent. So they're not employed, they're not owned, they are part of a team that all can have aligned incentives and actually can work together to improve the care of a community and do it in a much more cost-effective way. We also are looking at developing what we are calling complementary assets, either through contracts and relationships or through acquisitions, because really to coordinate care, you have to be able to manage the transitions of care. So what that means, if you're not a clinician, is that much of the waste that occurs in healthcare is between the primary care office and the specialty office, between the office and the hospital, between the hospital and the nursing home, between the nursing home and either back to home or back to the hospital. And so the ability to have partners that are skilled nursing facilities and acute rehab facilities and primary care docs and specialists and hospitals all working together to achieve the same end, that's how we're actually going to fix this problem. The other piece is developing the analytic capability. So as I mentioned, in the 90s when we tried to coordinate care, we really struggled because we didn't have real good information systems. The world in healthcare is much different than it was. I mean, just the fact that, you know, we're now approaching somewhere north of 50% of the systems now having electronic records in hospitals, and the physician offices are adopting the electronic records. The ability to digitize information and then share that information more readily is going to be critical, and is really that and the video technology, the digital video technology, are really the two things that are going to totally transform how we're able to deliver care going forward. So we're not, you know, we still count things like, well, how many office visits, how many surgeries, how many patients admitted to the hospital, but we're actually moving away from those as being the primary measures for us of success, because really it's more about what's the size of the community or the population of patients that we're accountable to manage and to help stay healthy. Because if we do our jobs correct, we will see fewer ER visits, we will see fewer surgeries, we will see admissions to the hospital go down, continue to go down. And so that's a totally different way of looking at the world, thinking of the world, and is really a change for healthcare. This is not us. So, you know, you all know this, but in this state, you've got the formation of another coordinated care organization, the Regional Provider Network. In Lincoln now, there are three different efforts to bring physicians together in partnerships to be able to coordinate care and help deliver on that triple aim. That's just been something that's evolved since January. And this is happening all around the country. I mean, it's not unique here. It's probably happened faster and it's further advanced on the coasts, but it's an issue that really we're all in healthcare having to deal with. And the changes are occurring, and I think for the most part the changes are positive. So I have lots of time for questions and would be happy to do my best to answer whatever questions I can.
Again, you have paper and pencil at your tables, and so please write those questions down and somebody will bring them up to me to read from here.
Thank you.
I'm going to get started with one of my own. I mean, this Affordable Care Act, you didn't talk too much about what you think the impact of that will be, but I'm just curious. We have, what, 10 million that now have insurance that didn't before? I mean, when you see people coming into your hospital, do you see people coming in more often having insurance now than they did before?
There's probably two answers to that. There's a political answer, and then there's an operational answer. So my answer, the impact of the Affordable Care Act is different in every state. So in the state of Washington, where I came from, the state chose to expand Medicaid. And so what we have seen in the state of Washington is a decrease in what we account for as charity care or the financial term is bad debt, but it's essentially unreimbursed care. The state of Nebraska has chosen not to expand Medicaid, so believe that there's been a real dramatic change in terms of the number of insured patients that are seeking care in our hospitals or in our clinics. We still have a very high load of uninsured, unreimbursed care. It's our mission, so we do it willingly and with a loving heart, to be quite honest with you. But it's, you know, roughly the last fiscal year, roughly $100 million of unreimbursed care that just our system alone provided. We're not complaining at all. This is part of why we're here, is to serve those that need us the most. But the Affordable Care Act has had a different impact in some states than in others. And primarily it's driven by the expansion of Medicaid, because as my understanding is, a lot or most of the newly insured folks really have picked up insurance through the Medicaid programs as opposed to the public exchanges.
You have spoken of relationships with long-term care, etc. How does that fit with what appears to be the breakup of the Emanuel system?
So there's two parts to that question. I'll answer the first part first, and then talk about our relationship with Emanuel. So We absolutely have to have relationships with long-term care, with skilled nursing, with acute rehab, because much of the costs in healthcare actually are driven by the variation of care that occurs in nursing homes, in rehab facilities. And so what we're learning through our Medicare, we're doing a bundled payment project that's sponsored by Medicare around total joint replacement. And this is primarily at Lincoln is to start. We're also going to be doing it in a couple of other of our hospitals. What we find in looking at the Medicare data that they provide to us because we're part of this project is that much of the variation in expense is driven by the variation of costs that come after the patient is discharged from the hospital. So there is variation that occurs at the hospital level, depending on the supplies that are used, the type of implant the physician uses. All of those things can drive variation in cost. But as soon as the patient's discharged, there's also a whole nother component of cost that vary widely. So it's very different in terms of what it costs for a Medicare patient to go to a nursing home for 7 days versus another one for 12 or 13 days versus an acute rehab facility. So if we're really going to look at total cost of care and try to be efficient and effective, we have to have relationships with long-term care, with skilled nursing, with acute rehab, because it's very much a part of what we do, the care that we deliver and provide, that just doesn't happen to exist inside the hospital. So that's the first thing. The second thing is we have a great relationship with Emmanuel and we'll continue to work with Emmanuel. One of the decisions that was made in the sponsorship transfer was that our skilled nursing homes, the Lighthouse Fontenelle, went to Emmanuel so that that would complement what Emmanuel's trying to achieve around its senior living mission. And our relationship with Emmanuel is different than it was today because we're not co-sponsors, but we work very closely with them and we'll continue.
There's about three questions here with regard to this next item. What is the status of the negotiations with Blue Cross? Is there a real danger that an agreement will not be reached?
Well, so since we've got the Blue Cross folks sitting here at the in the room, we could probably both address it. The way I would answer that question is that, you know, no one can predict the future. I think it is in the best interest of Blue Cross, as it is in the best interest of the network, to find a way to come together because, you know, the largest health plan in the state and the largest health system in the state really, if we were partners, could do some amazing things together that would not only improve the quality and the service, but I think would also drive the costs down to a more affordable level. So our organization is committed. You know, we continue to meet. In fact, I think our teams are meeting either now or they just met this morning. And we're going to do everything we can do to bring this to resolution. I can't predict the future, but I can tell you that the physicians of Uninet, because this is a negotiation between the docs that make up and run Uninet and Blue Cross Blue Shield, are very committed to moving away from the fee-for-service world because they all understand that model has driven us to do things like any business or industry would do, which at the end of the day have led to ever-increasing costs and, in many cases, don't facilitate the appropriate delivery of care or the quality, the focus on quality and outcomes that we should have. So there's plenty of the healthcare costs in this country. There's plenty of folks that are to blame, the biomedical device makers, the pharmaceutical companies, you know, the health plans, the providers. We're all in this together, and it's really I say this at New Employee Orientation. I've said this to my physician colleagues. I believe this is our decade, the provider's decade. If we don't fix healthcare, and when I say fix, I mean deliver even better outcomes at a lower cost. If we don't fix healthcare, then the market is going to fix healthcare for us, and we'll end up in one or two different places that I don't think is the right place for us, and I really don't think it would be the right place for patients. So we're committed as an organization, and here locally, this is all we talk about and all we think about. We spend, this year we're going to invest about $9 million into Uninet, and that investment is in people, coaches, health coaches. These are nurses that are embedded in our clinics that are doing things that the physicians don't do, the physicians aren't paid to do, which is call patients, follow up, help patients make sure they're taking their medicine, making sure they're doing the things that they need to do to improve their health. We are doing that because we believe it's the right thing to do, and that's what's going to help downstream in terms of keeping people out of the hospitals, keeping people out of our own emergency rooms, you know, preventing surgeries when they're not required. Those are the kind of things that are important, and that's the kind of care that we're trying to deliver and the physicians of UNIT are committed to deliver. So it's a long answer to a question. I think there's a reason for both us and Blue Cross Blue Shield of Nebraska to find a way to make this work, and we're very hopeful that we can.
90% of Medicare/Medicaid is spent on the last 30 days of life. Do you have any comments to your thoughts on this cost of care? Give examples of the type of care that may mean visits, that kinds of care, I can't get this, medical visits can treat. Anyway, Medicare, Medicaid.
So there's a couple of pieces to this, and I'm sorry, this will be a long answer because this is very near and dear to my heart. So one of the things I got to be involved in Tacoma back in the days when I was actually practicing was the development. I had a partner that practiced down the hall from me, and Dr. Pattison led the development of a program which started off, we called it Improving Care Through the End of Life. What I know as a primary care physician and what most physicians know is that we do spend a lot of money, we deliver a lot of care and services to people that are at the end of their life, and we don't really change the outcome, meaning it still is the end of their life. I mean, in fact, in this country and in most of our societies, we don't have a culture that is very comfortable talking about death and about how people want to die. Now, I lived in a state that that legalized physician-assisted suicide, and I absolutely don't believe in that. Absolutely. And in fact, I would say that the reason that you would want to, I mean, if you're at the end of your life or you have a significant medical illness and you want to interact with a healthcare provider, do you want to interact with somebody that's part of a faith-based organization that believes in the sanctity of human life always, or do you want to interact with somebody that doesn't? And it was really an interesting learning for me living in the state of Washington and going through this process and watching the death with dignity and the physician-assisted suicide legislation that ended up getting passed, because I absolutely think I personally believe that's the wrong way to approach this. But that does not mean that we shouldn't make significant investments in helping patients and family long before they're seriously ill talk about and decide how they want to manage the end of their life. So our Improving Care program that we put in place in Tacoma and started in the mid-90s has now led to, we have a huge palliative care program in the Franciscan Health System. We have physicians who are board certified in palliative medicine that are involved in our hospitals that are constantly available for patients and families, because it is, and we've all, maybe you haven't been through it, but I've been through it with my stepmom. It's incredibly difficult to get the families together to talk through what it is people actually want and how they want to die. One of the things that I also think is an issue in our country, and it is around our ability as physicians and clinicians to really talk about death, and because we're trained, and we're trained incredibly well, but for most physicians in the United States and probably around the world, but for physicians, a patient dying is almost a loss. It almost feels a bit like a failure. And so it's hard to really sit down and talk with somebody and be honest with them about it. It's like, you know, the likelihood that you're going to survive this condition or this diagnosis is not very good, and have those conversations around how do you want your life, how do you want the whatever is left in your life to be managed? How do you want that to actually play out? We need to do that as docs, and primary care physicians in particular need to be much better about having those conversations when you're healthy and when you're not in an ICU room. So it's a huge focus for us and will always be part of our mission.
How does CHS deal with compensation of MDs who teach medical students as part of their clinical practice?
Sounds like there's a plant in the audience. So
So the question was, is how do the how do we deal with the physicians who take medical students into their practice? And so that's actually not under my purview, because that is still something that is controlled by the Creighton University School of Medicine. I mean, that is what they do and decide. What our role is, since many of the faculty that are employed in ACC, we essentially are just the pass-through for their academic compensation. So I can't really answer how Creighton, or I don't even know how Nebraska manages or handles, you know, do they compensate physicians to allow students to follow them around? We have in the past, whether we will in the future, I don't know, and that's actually not something that I'm directly involved in.
What initiatives are you considering to address cost transparency?
So the question about cost transparency. So I personally believe that cost transparency is an important issue. And I think what we really need to do, and what healthcare really needs to do, is to embrace the transparency and to walk right into it with the one proviso. That what we get confused about is limited data that can be looked at and interpreted in multiple different ways, and not actually looking at the entire picture. So, you know, the crux of the issue that we have with Blue Cross Blue Shield that you've seen play out in the public is they're talking unit price, and we want to say it's way more than unit price. And it is way more than unit price. And I can prove it, because Medicare says we got to get out of the fee-for-service world. Medicare's paid, you know, relative to inflation, decreasing amounts on a fee-for-service basis, and Medicare still has a financial problem. So it's about how you manage care, and it's not whether or not you pay $1,000 or $900 for an ER visit. It's how many ER visits that occur that could have been delivered somewhere else or maybe even made unnecessary. So that's my perspective. If you talk to my colleagues at Blue Cross, they will give you the totally other side of the coin. But we're personally not afraid of cost transparency. But the problem is you can't look at just one piece of information. And the more we talk about cost, the more confused people are. The more, you know, Rick Ruggles writes about charges, the more people's eyes glaze over, because, you know, it's crazy that in healthcare we have a system where we charge way up here when we know we're only going to get paid something way down here, but we still charge way up here. That's actually part of this antiquated, broken reimbursement system that exists in this country in healthcare.
You know, you said you got to get cost under control, but that's been said for so many years. Is this really going to happen? I mean, do you see it down the road?
So we will be at a point as an organization in the not-too-distant future to be able to guarantee that we will get costs flat. So if you've read the news, the Boeing company, and I was part of these conversations for well over a year, the Boeing company, which is different, it exists up there than Nebraska, because the Boeing company came together and they have about 150,000, 170,000 people in their health plan up in the Puget Sound, roughly give or take, you know, about 70,000, I think, employees and then family members, but it's a big number. It's over 100,000. And Boeing said, you know, we're done. We can't continue to increase every year 10, 11, 12% increases in our health insurance costs. And so what Boeing did is used a company, Mercer, and they did an RFP, and they had health systems respond to this RFP, and they were looking for somebody that would take lead to develop a clinically integrated network, and the goal was to guarantee that their company's spend, medical spend, would be flat the first year of this program and would decline 3% in subsequent years. Now, I don't know, because I wasn't part of the last bit of the negotiations, but there are systems up there that are the two lead systems, University of Washington Health System and the Providence Swedish Health System, and they are bringing physicians together and hospitals together in these coordinated networks, and Boeing employees and their families will have the ability to choose, and the health systems are taking the risk on the cost. And we're positioning ourselves in the state to be able to do the exact same thing. Because we believe, and the physicians want to warranty not only their work, they also want to be accountable for the costs and the outcomes. So it is it is happening in other places in the country, and it can happen here as well. Again, you know, we may have different perspectives on how to get there faster or differently, but at the end of the day, we've got to get the cost piece under control.
You know, people go through their bills once in a while. I have to admit, even I don't do that when it's the hospital bills, because I have insurance. But when they do, they see some of these items, I don't know, Band-Aid that costs $2-3 or more. I mean, how are you addressing that kind of thing?
So, again, that goes back to what you see are the charges. And so this is this funny system, right? So there are some, like, health, you know, patients that come from out of the area and have a type of health insurance that you don't have a contract with. You get, as a hospital, you might get reimbursed as a percent of your charge. And so given that old system, what happened is of course, every hospital just figured out how to adjust its charges. In fact, the article that was in the Omaha World Herald, if you'll note, that Tenet was held out, the CUMC, using old data when it was owned by Tenet, was held out as having the highest charges for a specific type of admission in the county, right, or in the area. Well, Tenet is a for-profit, has an approach, has a model on how they use the charge master, is what it's called, to, you know, ensure that they meet certain revenue, you know, to achieve certain revenue targets. So, you know, one of the first things that Allegiant did when they took over CUMC was bring those charges down back to what was more consistent within our system. So when you get those EOBs, those explanation of benefits, you just have to be careful because it's confusing. And it is crazy. I'll tell you as a doc, we charge up here, and we know we're going to get paid 20-30% of what we charge. But there's all these little nuances and other little rules that if we charge too low, nobody's going to pay us more than we charged. And so we're always trying to make sure that we're not, you know, hurting ourselves by not charging appropriately based on the way health insurance pays providers. So it is a complex system. It needs to be reformed. And as I said before, and again, I'm just one perspective, and you know my bias, it's a system that is driving much of what is the problem with healthcare costs in this country. Because we are not paying physicians and hospitals more for delivering better outcomes. We're just paying them the same. The hospitals and physicians are paid more because they do more. It seems backwards to me.
Talk about the trauma center, which has been controversial here recently. We've got two of them in town competing with each other, supposedly, not cooperating with each other like they did before.
So the trauma decision wasn't ours. There's an opportunity here from our organization's perspective, but we're doing all the things that we need to do to be ramped up and ready to have our own 24/7, 365 trauma service. I came from Tacoma. Tacoma had two competing hospital systems who shared a trauma service, and we actually had a model that worked very, very well. Now, we weren't academic, so we didn't have the issues around residencies and fellowships that exist here between the two academic centers, which is part of what drove, I think, Nebraska's decision. One reason. There were probably others. But it is what it is now. So for us, what it is standing up our own level one trauma service that is 24/7, 365, gives us the opportunity as a phase two, if you will, to begin having conversations across our statewide network, two-state network, on how we develop a statewide trauma system with the goal of improving the trauma care that's delivered in the greater Nebraska communities that we serve. That would have been very difficult to do if we didn't have a trauma system and a level one service that was available every day, every hour, all year long. But now that we have that, we're going to use that as a foundational piece of our ability to improve trauma care across all the networks, all the communities that the network serves. It won't happen overnight. It'll be a multi-year process, but that's our plan now.
The competitiveness doesn't bother you.
Well, it is what it is. If you've heard, I think it's been announced that the way the EMS system is going to handle is they're going to do an every other day delivery of patients. So it is somewhat ironic that we had a shared trauma service, that now we have two trauma services, and the EMS is going to move, instead of, you know, closest proximity, is going to at least start off using an every other day model. And I understand the reasons why. I'm not saying that isn't an appropriate decision, but in many ways it still feels like it's going to be it's a shared trauma system.
Interested in having the speaker elaborate on the value-based system with insurers.
So there are all sorts of things that fit under this term value-based. So one example would be the bundled payment projects, where we're actually taking a specific condition, you know, hip arthritis, and a specific procedure, a joint replacement. And the way it works with Medicare is that what Medicare is doing is giving us a lump sum. And that lump sum has to cover everything from the physician's cost to the hospital cost to the nursing home cost or the rehab post-discharge to home health if that's needed. It covers things like, you know, if they need, you know, antibiotics because there's a complication. It's all covered by that lump sum payment. And what that is doing is that is getting the physicians together, looking at each other's data. The hospital and the nursing homes are all now sitting around the table saying, how do we make sure that we deliver care that fits within this lump sum that we're being given? And with this lump sum, Medicare has lots of strings. You've got to meet certain quality indicators. You've got to achieve a certain list of things that also make sure that the patient still receives the absolute best care. And if the systems can come together and save money out of that lump sum, then some of that money goes back to the providers. Some of it stays with Medicare. But so the issue really is it's a different way of thinking. Because today in the world, a physician who's an orthopedic surgeon, and they're all very good, but for them, all that really matters is their time in the OR, what they're paid for the procedure, and how much time they spend having to manage the patient afterwards. Now we have orthopedic surgeons sitting down around the table looking at all the different nursing home quality and results and costs and saying, okay, well, maybe we need to sit down with these three nursing homes and say, how do we want our care delivered to our patients and how do we do it in a more cost-effective manner? So that's one version. The other version is an all-in, where like the health systems are doing in the Northwest with Boeing, where, and again, I don't know what the final terms of their arrangement are, but the original idea was the health system was going to be at risk for costs that exceeded the agreed-upon budget. So that's another value-based model. So, for instance, our organization is a little over $2 billion organization. If we were paid differently, I can guarantee you we would make investments in different ways. So, as I said, behavioral health is vastly underserved in this state, as it is everywhere, because behavioral health is never well reimbursed. It's always it's not a large voting constituency generally, so they don't get a lot of attention. And yet we underinvest in behavioral health resources. And we as taxpayers, and again, sorry for the political commentary, but we as taxpayers end up paying a much higher cost because those poor patients end up in jails. They end up in the police station. They end up spending resources outside of our healthcare system because they don't have good access to, you know, ongoing care and treatment. So we as providers, if we had all the budget, we would look at things very differently in terms of how we would make investments. And really, the governor of Oregon, who's an ED doc, always used to tell a story, and I've heard him talk about it a couple of times, but he used to talk about how he was so frustrated as an emergency room physician because these Medicaid patients who had congestive heart failure would come into the hospital multiple times during the summer in Oregon. And it's because in Oregon and in Washington, very few people have air conditioners. And so if you have bad congestive heart failure, overheating can lead to fluid retention, which then, you know, when you have congestive heart failure and you have too much fluid on board, it consolidates in your lungs. You get short of breath. You end up getting admitted to the hospital until we can take the fluid out of your lungs, till we diurese you. And so what the governor would talk about is like how frustrated it was. We'd pay for 10 emergency room visits for a patient that had congestive heart failure, but the state wouldn't pay for a $400 air conditioner, which could have prevented many of them. So that's the problem in the model that we have now, that we have a disconnect. Going forward, we'd like to change that so we can make some different investments and we can change how we deliver care that actually is better for the patient and at the end of the day, even less costly.
Time for one more question, and we will have gone through most of them, but this person would like more from you on the utilization of nurse practitioners as primary care providers.
Yeah, I think there's a plant up here in the front. But so I'm an advocate of our advanced practice clinicians. I am not I'm not convinced, personally, I'm not convinced that we necessarily will have a doctor shortage, although there's, you can go out on the internet and you can look. There's a lot of people that are predicting that we'll have too few physicians to care for all the patients, and particularly with the baby boom generation continuing to kind of the demographics of the baby boom rolling forward. I was trained with and worked very closely with PAs and nurse practitioners, respect their skills and abilities and knowledge. And I think if there's ever an issue, and it's the same issue when you're talking to a primary care doc versus a specialist, there's always the potential for folks to practice sort of outside of their comfort area in terms of their skills and ability. And so this isn't just for nurse practitioners and PAs. This is for me as a primary care doc. And so it's something we always have to be thoughtful about. But when you use folks as teams, I'm much better as a primary care doc if I've got a cardiologist that's my partner who I can pick up the phone or I can FaceTime and say, hey, I've got this question, I've got this issue, here's the data on this patient. Is this the right approach? And so I really believe that we need to continue to promote the use and the training of these advanced practice clinicians, because they will play a very important role going forward, but it's part of team-based care. So not necessarily on their own, just not interacting with the primary care docs and specialists, but as part of a much larger healthcare team. I think they're a very important component, as are our pharmacists and our clinically trained nutritionists, and probably as our physical therapists and occupational therapists. That's all part of the team that need to work together to help people stay healthy or get well if they're sick.
Dr. Robertson, thank you very much.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club on Noon Forum. On today's program, we've heard a talk by Cliff Robertson, who recently assumed the position of Chief Executive Officer of Catholic Health Initiatives, Nebraska Southwest Iowa Network. Dr. Robertson discussed his vision and plans under study and development by Allegiant Creighton Health, named for the second consecutive year as one of the nation's 15 top health systems by Truven Health Analytics. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, July 24, 2014, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club presents these noontime educational forums each month. The next program will be Thursday, September 18th at 12 noon. At that time, we'll hear a discussion of the proposal to legalize horse race gambling in Nebraska. If you'd like to attend this or other future programs in the series, call the Omaha Press Club at 402-345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 400 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.